Hi everyone, and welcome to Dhamma Threads for another session of discussing the Sammadhikkhi Sutta, the Buddha's discourse on right view. And so we've been looking at this discourse, Majjhima Nikaya number 9, and in the translation, wonderful translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. So this is available in the book, The Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha. So we've looked at the topic of right view, which was a question that was raised in discussion between Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, and a group of bhikkhus. And we've looked at a number of topics over this series of talks. We've looked at the question of the wholesome and the unwholesome, the question of the different kinds of nutriment and conditions that keep being sustained. We've looked at the Four Noble Truths. And then we've looked at the various different factors of dependent origination. And in the Right View Sutta, the Sammadhikkhi Sutta, it talks about the factors of dependent origination starting from what's normally the end, which is aging and death, and then gradually works its way back up towards the causes, what's the causes of suffering. And so in our last session, we discussed the sixfold base, the senses, and how we receive the information from the world and how we build up that picture of the world. And for this session, we're going to be looking at the next factor of dependent origination, which is nama rupa. So Venerable Sariputta has just spoken on the sixfold senses, and the bhikkhus respond saying, good friend, sadhavaso. The bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words, and they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? And Venerable Sariputta replied, there might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands mentality materiality, or nama rupa, the origin of mentality materiality, the cessation of mentality materiality, and the way leading to the cessation of mentality materiality, in that way, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is mentality materiality? What is the origin of mentality materiality? What is the cessation of mentality materiality? And what is the way leading to the cessation of mentality materiality? So this is the definitions of these and analysis in accordance with the Four Noble Truths. Feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention, these are called mentality. So that's Vedana, Sanya, Jetana, Pasa, and Manasikara. The four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements, these are called materiality. So this mentality and this materiality are what is called mentality materiality. With the arising of consciousness, there is the arising of mentality materiality. With the cessation of consciousness, there is the cessation of mentality materiality. The way leading to the cessation of mentality materiality is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood mentality materiality, the origin of mentality materiality, the cessation of mentality materiality, and the way leading to the cessation of mentality materiality, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so this passage talking about nama rupa. To be frank, when we translate it into English, it's almost like what we call Buddhist hybrid English, right? Because this phrase, mentality, materiality, is not actually a meaningful phrase, really. So Venerable Bodhi has struggled to try to capture the term. It's not an easy one to capture. In his later translations, he's actually returned to translating it more literally as name and form. Okay? Often is translated as mind and body, but mind and body is definitely a mistranslation and shouldn't really ever be used in the context of nama rupa. It simply doesn't mean that. So, and I'll explain why in just a minute. So we're definitely struggling. So I might kind of prefer to use the Pali word, if that's okay. It's one of those phrases where it's one of those words where when you're translating it, in essence, you're just inserting a cipher anyway, right? You might as well just use a code term and say that's what it is, because there isn't any word in English that directly maps onto that. And when you try, you're just as likely to be misleading as anything else. So what actually is it? When I say that, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all that complicated, okay? It's not actually all that complicated, but it's that the context and the history of the word informs the term in a way which the people who are hearing the Buddha or Venerable Sariputta spoke, they would have understood, but which is lost to us, and I think was lost to the later generations of Buddhist commentators as well. So this is one thing. Well, let's just, before we look at the term in the Buddhist context, let's step back before the Buddhist context and ask, well, what did the term mean to the people that the Buddha was talking to? Okay? Now, nama-rupa is a very old, these are very old words, okay? Nama is in fact the English word name, right? That's what it is. It's a cognate with the English word name. And interestingly enough, the English word we pronounce today as name would have been pronounced nama up until what they call the Great Vowel Shift in English, which was about 400 or 500 years ago, something, the Great Vowel Shift. Anyone know when that was? Anyway, there was what they call the Great Vowel Shift. It's when pronunciation and vowels in English changed. And up to that time, what we say as name would have been pronounced nama. That's how persistent the word is, right? And it's still used in the time of the Buddha to mean simply name. When we're doing our ordination, the preceptor says, ko namo te upajaya, what's the name of your preceptor? Yeah, so we use the same word, just to mean name. So this is why the early generation of translators simply translated nama as name. The problem is, of course, that when it's defined in context like this, it obviously means something that's a bit more sophisticated than just name, doesn't it? I mean, it's defined here as feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention, right? So we have to then somehow bridge these two meanings, right? How does a word meaning name come to be used in this extended sense as a blanket term for a range of different mental qualities and mental phenomena, right? And this is where the problem is, because the word name in English never made that bridge, right? It always stayed as a word for just meaning name and never came to be a term that's used for mentality in that way. So in the pre-Buddhist time, nama was, as well as being used for name, comes to have a more pregnant kind of meaning, where this is all connected with the whole idea of self and not self, okay? Because we of course identify with our name, right? This is one of our primary forms of identification, is we attach to who we are, right? What are we called? Yeah? And to be able to label something, right, is to be able to capture the essence of something. Yeah? This is something that's very, very profound in human psychology, right? We still experience this today. You might know there's been studies of this in psychology where they show that if you can actually name something, it will reduce your stress. Why? Well, because somehow it's become knowable, right? It's not so scary. It's not the unknown. The unnamed is something which is out there, which is mysterious. So when we name things, we like bring it within the realm of the known, yeah? And we think about what that actually means to name something, right? It talks about it in the Bible, right? God and Adam go around, they name all the animals, right? What does that mean? It means you have a form, right? And you have a name for it. Ah, this one is a wildebeest. This one is a gnu. This is a lizard, right? You have a name and a form. And it actually helps you to make sense of the world. Science is still doing that, right? It's one of the things that science does, right? Goes around and tries to get all of the animals and all the plants in the world and give them all a name, right? And so we categorize things, we bring them in within the realm of the known and the knowable. Yeah? So as we're growing up, right, we can see through our childhood development, again, we learn the names for things. Yeah? When we're born, we don't know the names of things. We grow up, we gradually learn, we explore. And what we know and what we can know becomes directed and made possible through the power of name. Yeah? So originally we see things around us and we maybe develop names for those things, mummy and daddy and so on. But then you gradually learn that, well, you can have a name for something that you've never even seen. Yeah, or you've never a name for a place you've never even been to. So you're extending your world. You're extending the power of the mind over this world. And so this ability to name things through human evolution and the growth of human society and culture, as people became more and more aware and more conscious of this, they started to reflect on this ability to name things and the power that it had. Yeah? Often it's believed within magical cultures that a person's essence is inherent in their name. Yeah? We're familiar with this idea. If you know somebody's true name, then you can do spells and you have power over them. Yeah? People have secret inner hidden names that are actually part of their essence of who they are. Yeah? Now, in the Brahmanical tradition, before the time of the Buddha, there was reflection about this kind of ideas, and the idea of nama rupa, the idea that each thing in the world had its own name, which captured its identity and its form, right, its appearance, the way that it appeared in the world. Huh? And there began to be a movement that would go beyond this, okay, to reflect, is this all the world consists of? Is names concepts and the things that they are concepts of, right, the names and the forms, right, the appearances of things, and the things that those appearances are called. Is that all there is in the world? People began to realize that sometimes identities shift, they change. Sometimes appearances are deceptive, right? Sometimes we think we understand something because we have a name for it, and actually it turns out to be something else. So he realized that this world of name and form actually is illusory, right? And so in the Brahmanical tradition, the Upanishadic tradition, about 200 or 300 years before the Buddha, they began to look at not the name and form, but at the underlying consciousness of these things. Yeah? So this is this great shift which happened in Indian culture before the Buddha to focus attention on the knower. Right? And this is something which is absolutely characteristic of Indian philosophy, and was very, and marks the point where it departed from Western philosophy and other philosophical systems around the world. That absolute focus on who is the knower, who is the I, yeah? Who is the one in the middle. And so in the Upanishads, for example, we get imagery like just as the each of the rivers has its individual name and shape, right? It's nama and it's rupa, yeah? And they all lose their name and their shape when they go down into the great ocean. Yeah? And all of the rivers have disappeared in the great ocean, and it's just the great ocean. Yeah? And the nama and the rupa have disappeared. Yeah? In the same way, we all have our namas and rupas, right? I'm Sujato, and I have this form, and this is how I appear. But when we die, or when we get enlightened, or whatever, according to that system, all of those things disappear, and there's just the great ocean of vijnana, yeah, vijnana ghanameva. Right? It all disappears into that vijnana ghanameva, that sheer mass of consciousness, yeah? Which of course is the Atman. Right? So this is that Upanishadic philosophy which appeared about 200 or 300 years before the time of the Buddha. And one of the concerns of the Buddha was to critique this philosophy. Right? Now there's something which is very beautiful and quite profound about that idea. Right? There's an insight which underlies it, but at the end of the day, it's still attached to this idea of consciousness and the idea of the self. Right? And so, but so the Buddha is picking up this Upanishadic idea of nama rupa and is critiquing it and analyzing it. Okay, so we have to understand this. This is why the context is absolutely critical in this particular case. And the later generations of Buddhist commentators weren't familiar with the context, so they tended to ignore it. And this is why we find that nama rupa gets misinterpreted to mean mind and body in later generations. In fact, it doesn't mean that. So what it means, again, just to sum up, nama is the concepts, the names, the ideas we have in our minds about the world. And rupa is the appearances that things have. Okay, actually, appearance is actually quite a good translation for rupa. Yeah, possibly the best one. Yeah, it's difficult to translate rupa very well, but appearance is actually quite a good one. So rupa is the way that the physical world appears or manifests in your mind. Right? Remember that the physicality in Buddhism is always interpreted subjectively, not objectively, like it is in science. Eh? So it's the four great, we translate it as the four great elements, right? This is earth, water, fire, and air. But these things are not the objective elements, but they're the manifestation of these things in the mind. So earth is not the sort of the thing that exists out there, but earth is the quality of hardness, right? Fire is the quality of heat. Water is the quality of liquidity, and so on. So all of these have certain physical attributes and qualities which appear and manifest in your mind. You are aware of them. Yeah? And that's what rupa is referring to. It's referring to the appearance of physical things. Yeah? So again, this is why the word materiality isn't that great. It certainly doesn't just mean matter. I mean, it obviously includes energy for a start. Anyway, so rupa is typically perceived through the five senses, right? But it's important to understand also in Buddhism that rupa is also perceived through the mind. Okay? So if, for example, if I imagine a house in my mind, that is also a rupa. Even though it doesn't exist physically, but it's an appearance of a physical thing. Yeah? So like an echo or a memory or an idea of a physical thing is also considered to be a rupa. So, just to come back to these definitions, I'm conscious that I've been talking quite a lot here, but it's quite a subtle topic, so I think it needs a bit of background. So then we come to these definitions. So what do these definitions mean? Well, when we understand from this point of view, then the Buddha defined things, right? His definitions always should be considered as responses, okay, or corrections. Okay, so in other words, when he's saying mentality is feeling, perception, contact, and attention, okay, what he's saying here is this quality of nama, which was perceived as being some kind of mystical quality, which was our identity and who we really are. When we look at that closely, we realize that actually it's just these psychological factors, right? And we can investigate these psychological factors and see that our naming, our conceptualizing is actually driven by these things, right? It's driven by our feelings about things, right? I mean, when your name is questioned, right, you feel bad, yeah? And so actually we don't think of feeling and name as being part of the same thing, do we? But in reality they are. You know, what does it feel like if you open up your Facebook page one morning and you realize someone's written something awful about you, right? You feel terrible, right? And so you try to defend your name because you don't want to have those bad feelings, right? So for feeling and name is actually quite closely linked. And same thing with perception, right? How do you actually know things? How do you make sense of the world? Yeah. So this also is our idea, our name of somebody, yeah. Allows us to categorize people, right? We can, for example, we can put people in political parties, right? You're this, you're right wing, you're left wing, something like that. Or we could put things in a religious background or an ethnic background or something like that. So we can categorize people. We can categorize them in terms of our memory, right? Somebody might say something about a person, and then we might have a memory that person acted in such a way in the past, and we'll say, oh yeah, well that's the kind of person they are, yeah? And so we're imposing our name on the reality. Similarly, I won't go into too much detail, I don't want to talk for too long, but similarly with volition and contact and attention, we can analyze these and look at them and we see that actually all of these are contributing to forming and sustaining this idea of name, both our own personal name and identity, but also those of others. Yeah. So this is that process which in the Indian traditions they call ahankara, is I-making. Yeah. So this making of an I, making of an identity, is an active process that we have to work at. This is really important to understand this. We think from a Buddhist point of view, we often think, oh, it's really hard to let go of the self. Yeah? The hard thing is actually to sustain the self. Right? This is a hankara. It's an active process. I'm making. If you don't make the self, it dissolves by itself. Right? All you have to do is stop reinforcing it. And these are the forces which reinforce the self and which build up that idea of a self, yeah? Feeling, vedana, perception or sanya, volition or cetana, passa or contact, and manasikara or attention. And so these are regarded as being conditions, mental factors, which are present in every moment of consciousness. Yeah? So they call the sabbasadharana cetasika in the Abhidhamma tradition is the universal concomitants. So this is the nama and the rupa. Of course, I mentioned the four great elements, earth, water, fire and air, and also derive materiality. So they have this thing, upadaya rupa, which is mentioned regularly in the suttas, but it's never actually explained or defined in the suttas what derived materiality is. So there's a lot of discussion about this in the traditions, but one of the ways of thinking about this derived materiality is of more subtle forms, like I mentioned, the mental images of matter which appear in your mind can also be thought of as derived materiality. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's just one example of what this can be considered as. So notice that the arising of consciousness is said to be the arising of nama rupa. So these things very closely linked, yeah? Consciousness, the awareness of nama rupa, is what we are aware of. Okay, so these things always arise together. Consciousness always arises with its object. Yeah? There's an awareness, and there's an awareness of something. Again, this is part of the Buddha's critique of the Upanishadic tradition. The Upanishadic tradition was, we can get rid of nama rupa, and when all those rivers dissolve into the ocean, all there is sheer awareness. Yeah? And so the Buddha said, well, look into your experience. What do you see? And what you see is that awareness, vijnana, always arises together with nama rupa. Yeah? These two things are inseparable. Imagine that you didn't have any... Imagine you're a baby. Yeah? You can't make sense of the world. You're looking around, it's just colours and lights and you can't make any sense of things, right? Gradually you learn that for example, this blob of thing comes and goes, and that blob of thing stays, right? And then you kind of realize, oh, this is a ceiling that I'm staring at, and this is mummy, yeah? And you differentiate between these kind of blobs, and then gradually you learn that, yeah? So the more names you have for things, right, the more you can actually distinguish, the more finely you can distinguish your experience. Yeah? So your experience is conditioning your ability to conceive. Imagine that you were brought up in a sensory deprivation chamber, right? You could never actually learn these things. So that your sensory input enables you to conceptualize, but your conceptualizing then triggers more sensory learning. Yeah? So these things always go together. And the Buddha actually talked about these things with an astonishing degree of sophistication. In one of the suttas, the Mahanidana Sutta, he talks about two kinds of contact, patika sampasa and adivacana sampasa. Patika sampasa is experienced through the five external senses, or through rupa, and patika literally meaning impact, okay, or resistance. Yeah, patika literally meaning resistance, and adivacana meaning designation. And this is association with nama. So rupa is associated with patika sampasa, with resistance contact or impact contact. And nama is associated with designation contact. Yeah? So these things always working together. So again, imagine, try to think what these things mean. So for example, if we think about the eye, right? Light comes and impacts our eye, right? And we know that this happens, right? We know that there is an energy, right? It was the real physical energy which actually hits things in the back of your eye, and that's what enables the sense of sight to work. Without that patiga, without that impact, it can't work. The same thing with the ear. Actually, something has to physically strike your ear before you can hear anything, and so on. Yeah, but we can't make sense of that without actually designating it. Yeah, so your mind has to work to make sense of, oh, this is a sight, this is a sound. Right? Distinguish all the different senses and then somehow meaningfully put that into a word. So when I see Tina walking in the room, there's a sound of Tina saying hello, there's a sight of Tina and all of those things, but in my mind I have to put them all together with the adivacana and make sense of it and say, oh, this is Tina. And that, and see, the thing is that that is what gives the illusion of permanence. Because the names stay the same. You're born with your name. Your identity is given by your name. You're given at birth, right? And you keep that same name through your whole life. Yeah? And so this is why we think, oh, that's permanent. The names are permanent. But the thing that the name is of is always changing. If you don't learn how to name things, you can never learn how to not name things. Right? I mean, imagine if we were, again, if you think about it in terms of infant development. If a child doesn't learn names and self and all of those things, how can it actually grow and develop? It can't even become a real adult, yeah? So these things have a purpose, right? They have a function. Right? The problem comes when we instead of thinking of it as something which is contingent and practical, right? Then we actually it sinks deeper, and we think that it's actually real and permanent and true, and that's where the attachment comes through. So you know, you think about that. Say in terms of career would be an obvious one, right? I mean, you know, in a certain sense, like if you want to front up for a job interview, right? I mean, you have to present yourself in a certain way, right? You're going to tell them about all the good things you've done, and you're going to leave out some other bits and pieces, and you're going to try and be charming and so on and so forth, yeah? And that's kind of playing the game, and that's all right. I mean, that's just, you're just trying to be the best person that you can, and you're trying to give the information and so on. But do you actually believe that, right? You know, there's this kind of sense. I mean, Shakespeare is always kind of saying the world, life is but a play, right? And there's a great degree of truth to that. We do step in and out of roles, and we play those roles. And if we hold those roles lightly, yeah, then it's actually not a problem. And we can go to work and we can step into that role. We can go home. We can be in the family and step into that role. And we can be with our friends and step into that role. And in a sense, these are all personas. And I guess the Buddhist point of view is that there's no true self, right, for which these things are masks. Yeah? All there is masks. Yeah? Nama Rupa is just a set of masks. Yeah? And so when you mistake the mask and you think that this is who you really are, this is where the problems come in. One, I think, of the great differences between Western and Eastern psychology, and this is true in Buddhism, but also in Hinduism, use the same word, this idea of ahankara. And Buddhism has ahankara, also mamankara, is mind-making. Yeah? In Western psychology, they tend to talk of the ego. Right? So you have this ego, which is a thing. Yeah? And, of course, this is very famous from Freud's psychology. And not many people know that Freud actually never used the word ego in any of his writings. Yeah? Nor did he ever use the word id in any of his writings. Yeah? And he was, of course, writing in German, and he used the words the I and the it in German, of course. And when they translated him into English, they thought that didn't sound kind of formal enough, so they used the Latin words for it. Yeah? Interesting, again, to notice that how the translations affect things. I mean, if you're using just a natural language, you talk about the I, well, it makes much more sense than talking about the ego. I always remember when I first heard about this, I was thinking, what is the ego? I was looking for a thing, right? What is this thing? And I couldn't understand. From a Buddhist point of view or Indian point of view, it's not a thing, it's an act. Yeah? Ahankara is an act. Yeah? I making. Yeah, so it's not something that we have, it's something that we do. Yeah? And that's a completely different way of looking at it compared to Western psychology. Particularly, you know, if you want to particularly begin with insight meditation and to understanding how these processes work, yeah, you know, the best place I think is always to start with directly with the six senses. Yeah, awareness of what's actually happening through the sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and then awareness of the responses to that. Yeah, whether you like something or don't like it, you're sitting in meditation, you hear a sound, you're annoyed by the sound, so you see the feeling that's arising. You see, but then you start to see the way that your perception is then shaping your experience, right? So, for example, you maybe hear somebody talking, and then that triggers a thought about that person, a perception about that person, and so on. And that's already that process of ahankara, eye-making, and nama, and all those factors are already there. Yeah? So you actually start to see that process unfolding. But you only get clarity about that process when you can strip it back before that and actually see what the bare experience is. Yeah. Just as an analogy, think about it in terms of, let's say, if you wanted to evaluate a scientific experiment, right? Imagine that that somebody had done a scientific experiment, and you suspected that the results were skewed because of the bias of the authors of the experiment. Okay. How would you go about testing that, right? You read the experiment, you think, well, it sounds like they're really pushing a particular point of view. You know, I wonder if that... Okay, how would you do that? Well, you have to go back, you look at the methodology, and ultimately you look at the data and how the data was collected. Yeah? So you have to strip it right back, go back to the basics. What actually are the figures? What are the numbers? You analyze that for yourself, and then you see how did they take those numbers and turn it into their conclusion. And sometimes... maybe they did that well, maybe sometimes they didn't, maybe sometimes you can draw other conclusions from it. But unless you actually go back to the data, yeah, it's just one set of opinions versus another. Yeah. So this is why I say don't worry about this nama rupa initially when you want to do insight meditation. Yeah. Initially you get back to what is the senses, what is the sense data, what's the reality that you're experiencing? And you stay with that as long as you can, because those things are already wrapped up in layer upon layer upon layer of delusion and perception and memory and feeling and emotion and all of those things, even before we're aware of it. Yeah? And when we think we've got through to the sound or the sight and so on, it's already pre-wrapped and pre-digested. Yeah? So we need to spend a lot of time peeling back the layers of the onion, going deeper and deeper and deeper until we can really see those things for what they are. Gradually then we understand how the onion is assembled, come back out again. Ah, this is how this happened, this is how this happened. Yeah? And then you can see how that process works and how the identity is constructed.